Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And this pre-recorded show is especially arranged so that I can interview Joanna Moncrief, have a chat with my friend Joanna Moncrief. She's a senior lecturer in the Department of Mental Health Sciences at the University College of London in the UK. She's the co-founder of the Critical Psychiatry Network in Great Britain, which is, as I understand, a kind of a coalition of professionals who are concerned about ethics, honesty, and, real evaluations of current psychiatric treatments. Joanne is the author of The Myth of the Chemical Cure, a critique of psychiatric drug treatment. You can get it in paperback now. It's a very, very good book, The Myth of the Chemical Cure. Joanne is the kind of friend that I often think about, but being not so good a friend sometimes across the great ocean, I just don't talk to very often and don't communicate with very often and only see once in eternity. So I thought one way to cure that is to have her on my show. Joanna, are you there from Great Britain?
I am, Peter, yes.
I'm so glad to hear your voice.
It's lovely to come on the show. Really nice to talk to you again, Peter.
Do you want to just introduce yourself further to our listeners, some of whom have probably read your book? I'm sure some have. Some of whom have heard of you. But tell us a little more about yourself.
Yes, certainly. My background is I'm a psychiatrist and I work in London. And I work as a practicing consultant psychiatrist for part of my week in northeast London, in the NHS in England. And for part of my week, I am a senior lecturer at University College London.
Now, a senior lecturer, is that like a professor here?
It's like an assistant professor.
Assistant professor?
Yeah.
And so go ahead, just continue. You're also a mother.
I am, yes. I've got three children, yes. So I'm juggling a lot of things.
And a writer.
Yes.
And something of an organizer in terms of reform psychiatry.
I started the Critical Psychiatry Network in the 1990s when I met a group of like-minded psychiatrists, and we've carried on meeting and campaigning and supporting each other since that time. And I know that we, you know, various members of the group as well as myself have had links with you and with your organizations over the years.
How far back do we go? We met quite some time ago. I'm kind of vague about it, but I know, gosh, we've known each other for many, many years now.
We first met at a debate that was organized in London, which was the title of the debate was something like Psychiatric Drugs Do More Harm Than Good.
We actually met there.
And I seem to remember. Sorry?
Yeah, we actually met there. I thought we probably met earlier, but tell folks about that. That was quite an experience.
I think that was probably the first time we actually had met face to face. I mean, obviously, I'd known about your work for a very long time. But I think that's the first time we met face to face. Anyway, I think the general consensus was we wiped the floor with the opposition. So that was an interesting evening. But it was also interesting that it had proved quite difficult to find anyone who was prepared to come along and debate. And that has been my experience, and I think your experience, you know, over our careers, that we put these ideas out there. We do very careful research. We're coming up with very plausible ideas, and no one is actually prepared to discuss them and confront them.
Yes, it's so much a matter of power and authority. Do you think there's more openness in Great Britain or less, or in Europe than in the U.S.?
Well, the influence of the pharmaceutical industry is less than it is in the U.S., particularly because we don't have direct-to-consumer advertising. Of course, lots of material gets to consumers via the internet, but we're not bombarded with advertisements on television and the radio all the time. So I think that's one difference, and means that probably European society has been slightly less focused on drug treatments than the United States. And probably the profession is a little bit less dominated by biological psychiatrists as quite a respectable social psychiatry movement looking at the social determinants of mental breakdowns.
Well, so when I became a psychiatrist, I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead, Joanna.
No, it's probably a slightly more open environment over here. Yes,
yeah.
You carry on.
I think it is a somewhat more open environment. I'm fond of saying that every 10 years, they come up with some very important psychiatrist in Great Britain to debate me, and every 10 years, and one of those 10 years, you were my partner in the debate, and then they don't dare again for another 10 years. But in the U.S., the last time a prominent psychiatrist debated me was in the mid 80s on Oprah Winfrey when I debated Max Fink, the president of the APA, and he didn't do real well. So. They just don't have a lot to offer. What about the situation with children? It's really getting just worse and worse in the U.S. You know, we've had the scandals here with this concept of bipolar disorder in childhood. We've probably got 10-12% of our boys on attention deficit disorder medications. It's really a very bad situation here with the children.
It's a shocking situation, isn't it? The difficulty is that it's difficult to obtain figures for the numbers of children that are prescribed psychoactive medication in this country, so we don't really know. Anecdotally, definitely the use of drug treatment in child psychiatry is becoming more frequent, more common. You know, when I started psychiatry, it was really quite uncommon. And now it's normal if a child has mental health to be on some sort of psychiatric medication, mostly. But it's difficult to trace the exact numbers of the exact different types of medications. We definitely are seeing the same trends of increased use of different sorts of drugs overall in the UK. I've just been looking at that data, and, you know, there's been a massive increase in the use of antidepressants, but also, more worryingly, there's been quite a considerable increase in the use of antipsychotics over the last 10 or 12 years. And I think that mirrors the situation in the United States. And the other worrying thing, again, with got more data from the United States, is that an awful lot of these drugs are being prescribed off license for indications for which they've never been tested. And that implies that they might be being used in children as well.
Now, in Great Britain, you were kind of ahead of us in terms of discovering that drug monitoring agency ahead of us in emphasizing the risks of suicidality associated with the antidepressants in children and youth and their lack of efficacy. But you're saying that that hasn't stopped a new surge of giving them to children?
Well, like I say, we haven't got the data on whether they're being prescribed to children or not, but we have got data that show that overall there's been a massive increase in the use of antidepressants. It doesn't look as if the warnings that went out about them possibly increasing suicidal thoughts and actions have stemmed the massive flood. In general, people are... that they're being prescribed more frequently.
Do you have some thoughts about what this is all about in Great Britain, socially, economically, this different view of children and adults?
Well, you mean what's behind this increasing drug use?
Yeah, just the pharmaceutical industry, but, you know, sort of the whole picture, because I know you're thoughtful about this, and I haven't had anybody on the show from the UK talking about the culture of the changing view of this whole idea of the biochemical imbalance and so on.
Yeah, I mean, we live in a very consumerist world where there's this idea that there's a quick fix out there that you can go out and buy for anything. And that's sort of spilled over into our personal lives so that, you know, people want to think that they can take a pill and that's going to solve all sorts of difficult and complicated problems, that if they had to look at them more deeply, they would realize actually, you know, would take quite a bit of time and effort to sort out. And so I think, the sort of society that we've become encourages this use of drugs. It's just wanting a quick fix, wanting to do everything quickly. And also, I think there's enormous pressure on people to perform, you know, at a very high level in all areas of their life nowadays. You know, very high expectations on people. And so I think people are very sensitive about maybe not living up to those expectations. And tend to, you know, sometimes look for a medical explanation if they feel they're not managing as well as they feel they should be or they're told that they should be. So I think there's a lot of pressures on people in everyday, you know, in modern life. And that's sort of driving people to this idea that maybe you can take a drug and it will fix it.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true. Do you have groups in Great Britain like our CHAD, which is, you know, children and adults with attention deficit disorder, that is supposed to be a consumer group but is actually AstroTurf, we call it. It's actually funded by drug companies, or the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which is, again, supposed to be representative families and patients, but is actually, again, AstroTurf and gets drug company money?
We have some groups like that. So the Depression Alliance has received some drug company money. I haven't looked at the latest data, but it has in the past. What else? Some of the old age groups, I'm afraid, Age Concern and the Alzheimer's Society, I think that's the Alzheimer's Society,
yes.
Has received some drug company money. But there is probably less of that going on here than there is in the States.
What other differences do you see? I mean, what happens to the availability of psychotherapy or couples therapy or family therapy or children's therapy in public health arena, in your method of funding, you know, through the government?
Yeah, it's a very different health system, isn't it? And it was the case a few years ago that that some people in some areas could get long-term psychotherapy, which would be funded by the NHS. That's becoming rarer and rarer, and what will be funded by the government now are short courses of CBT, very short courses for most people,
mm-hmm.
and psychotherapy would essentially have to be done privately now. And I think, you know, from what I hear, it's, you know, with the current economic climate, psychotherapists are struggling.
Now, you mentioned CBT. That's cognitive behavioral therapy, for those in our listening audience who aren't up on the lingo, which is a very specific kind of therapy that doesn't go into depth into childhood and doesn't necessarily get into a lot of emotional expression or even a lot of relationship. It attempts to correct thinking and correct behavior. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, and I think cognitive behavioral therapy has been appealing because supposedly it can be quite effective in a short period of time, and so it's almost like the therapeutic equivalent of the drug in that it's a quick fix, short term, and getting people, supposedly getting people back to work. The British government have put quite a lot of money into funding this therapy recently, but we haven't seen any outcome data yet about whether that initiative has been helpful, whether it's really helped people get back to work, which was one of the motivations behind it. Seems very unlikely it's going to be able to achieve that in the middle of a deep recession. But we shall see if they do publish
that's an irony,
the data
isn't
they're
it?
Collecting.
Yeah, CBT for economic depression. I think one reason that CBT is favored, and it is by our government when they set up experiments at NIMH comparing drugs and therapy, they like to compare it to CBT. And I think one reason, several reasons for that. One is it isn't really the kind of therapy that works. It's not the therapy of most therapists, which is a much more mixed approach where you have a caring relationship and you put emphasis on the relationship, where you also generally put emphasis on self-insight of the individual and learning about the individual's past, a kind of a mix of different things that seems to help the particular individual. So if instead you compare this more in its pure form, sterile kind of therapy that has a fairly routine and rote kind of responses, it really sounds more medical, looks more scientific, and is just less, I think, humanly connected. Is that an exaggeration from your view and experience?
No, I agree. So it's similar to drug treatment in that way, isn't it? You know, the model is that the person comes into the room, and instead of trying to understand that individual's particular history, problems, past, etc., what you're trying to do is stick a diagnostic label on them. They've got depression or anxiety or PTSD, and then you're applying the treatment to the label, to the diagnosis. That's the model that underlying the use of antidepressants, the use of almost all drug treatments, and the use of CBT. And I would agree with you that the way to really help people is to treat them as individuals, is to find out what their individual problems are, and then, you know, tailor your help and support to what those problems consist of.
Talk some more about the fate of psychotherapy. There in this country, a lot of people go for psychotherapy. A lot of psychotherapy is covered to some degree under private health insurance. It is very poorly covered under public health insurance, like Medicare for the older folks like me, and Medicaid for the poorer folks covers it poorly. It's interesting, in New York State, for example, all insurance companies are required to cover therapy except the state itself, which has its own health program for people who are, economically more stressed, and it doesn't cover psychotherapy very well at all, if at all.
Yeah.
So, it's hard when you get health insurance under the government to cover therapy.
Well, I suppose it's, you know, proper psychotherapy is usually a long process. It's not something that you can just hurry up and do quickly. As I said, it was available for people with quite complex problems on the NHS in many areas of the UK, but that's increasingly less common because people who were in NHS employment as psychotherapists, as full-time psychotherapists, those posts are being scaled back, basically. So it's less available than it was.
So what happens in Great Britain to, a 30-year-old working person who would like to get some psychotherapy? What do they do? Where do they go? How much does it cost?
I mean, generally, they would have to go privately, unless their problems were severe enough that they were deemed suitable for secondary care mental health services, in which case they'd be likely not to be working. So if they were working and their problems weren't that severe, they'd probably just have to find someone themselves if they wanted proper psychotherapy. What is available, as I said, is a short course of CBT.
Mm-hmm. So who would they go to in Great Britain? I'm just trying to help people understand what differences are in Great Britain. And I'm also concerned about the issues of national health care and its effect on psychotherapy. Who would they go to? Would they go to a psychologist for therapy, psychiatrist, social worker? More and more here, clinical social workers are doing therapy.
Peter, I'm probably not the best person to ask.
Not the best. I thought I picked up I apologize for pushing you.
No, it's okay. I mean, psychotherapists are, you know, have a range of backgrounds, and there are a range of different qualifications. There isn't any sort of central body. There are various bodies that control different groups of them, regulate different groups of psychotherapists. That's as helpful as I can be. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Would you like to talk some about your own work, about your book, basic themes that you're exploring and investigating, and talk about your book?
Yeah, I'd love to, and I'd like to come back to your work as well, talking about that. At the moment, I'm writing a book on the history of antipsychotic drugs, and I'm writing that partly because of what we talked about earlier, because of this sort of epidemic of use of these really toxic substances. So these are drugs like brand names as Zyprexa, Seroquel, these are the new ones. The old ones are Thorazine and Haloperidol. And so I'm writing a history of those, looking back at a lot of the work that you looked at about the early years of their use, when the clinicians who were using them were very honest about them. And, you know, they were writing detailed descriptions about how these, you know, switched off the nervous system, suppressed the nervous system, paralyzed the nervous system. They were called neuroplegics to start with. And how they described what people looked like who'd taken these drugs, how they were sort of slowed up and lost their initiative and were emotionally dumbed down. So I'm looking at all that data and how all that information got lost as they started to be presented as a disease targeted treatment, as a magic bullet for schizophrenia. And then what I think happened, you see, is that idea that they were a magic bullet allowed them then to be marketed to a much wider section of the population, which is why we now end up in a situation where they're being prescribed to children with so-called bipolar disorder, to adults with bipolar disorder and lots of other, you know, quite vague and non-specific problems and situations. So that's what I've been doing at the moment. And my previous book looked at drugs in general and again traced that history from the time when they were understood to be drugs that altered the body, that modified the way the body worked and generally impaired normal functioning, which goes back to your idea about brain impairing treatments. And how that idea got lost, got covered over by this myth, this figment that they were really targeted treatments.
It is most amazing to think about that change. I remember when I first started to explore these issues, and I picked up a standard textbook of psychiatry from probably the early 60s. And they showed a diagram of a brain, and they showed dopamine nerves going into the
frontal lobes from deeper down in the basal ganglia going on up into the frontal lobes, the very same or similar fiber tracts that are cut in lobotomy, the major pathway to the frontal lobes of the brain. And I thought, gee, I'm going to look under the picture and it's going to say antipsychotic drugs cause lobotomy. And instead, under the picture, it said these must be the pathways affected in schizophrenia because these drugs work on these pathways.
Yes.
And it was just such a clear picture, such a model of disrupting the same fiber tracts.
Yeah.
One could have used it as a lobotomy, for a lobotomy illustration.
Yeah. Well, there's been the most extraordinary situation recently, which has, you know, ended up completely vindicating your position that these drugs cause brain shrinkage and brain damage. So with the fashion for the use of antipsychotics and the rise of this early intervention movement, this idea that you should start treatment quickly in young people who might or might not have psychosis, with the rise of that movement came this idea that that schizophrenia was a progressive form of brain damage, so that if you didn't start treatment early, the person's brain would get more and more damage and shrink. And this was based on some imaging studies that showed that there was shrinkage of the brain. And this, of course, completely ignored what you'd been saying years earlier, that this brain shrinkage was related to drug treatment. You know, you'd said this in the 80s when these studies first started to be done using CAT scans. And everyone ignored it. And I remember, to my shame, as well as a junior doctor, reading what you'd written and thinking, oh gosh, that can't be true. Surely that can't be true. Surely that must be too, that's just too awful to contemplate, that our drugs, I didn't think they were much good, but I couldn't quite accept that they actually might be causing brain damage to that extent and shrinking the brain. And so, as I said, recently this idea was revived and it was used to justify starting drug treatment, you know, even earlier in young people when you don't even know whether they're really psychotic or not. And now it turns out, with a publication last year by Nancy Andreasen, no less, the professor, a leading psychiatric professor who was editor of the American Journal of Psychiatry for a long time, her group has published a paper showing definitively, really, because it's a large sample, that this drug shrinkage is correlated with antipsychotic treatment. And so what you were saying back in the 80s has now shown, you know, been shown to be true. And I think because of that, there has been a slight backing away from this idea of, you know, this idea that you have to start drug treatment very early to stop the brain shrinkage. I mean, essentially, what she's shown is what you were saying all along, that this brain shrinkage is nothing to do with schizophrenia. It's to do with the drug treatment that we're giving to people.
Of course, that's what her data is showing, but as I remember, her group is not exactly saying that. She kind of said that in a New York Times interview, and then when she said they were even reluctant to publish this data, they were just looking at it, it was so dreadful. And then 2 years later, they publish it, and the data is there, but they're not saying, we've now shown that the drugs are doing this. I think it's more the data, isn't it? Or am I...
Well, no, they have admitted that the drugs are associated with brain shrinkage. And that was in, a 2011 paper, but they published another paper after that saying that the drugs cause some of the shrinkage, but we think some of the shrinkage is also due to schizophrenia. I can't see how they can possibly show that because they don't have a control group who haven't been treated with drugs. Everyone in their sample is on drugs. So it seems to me they cannot definitively disentangle the effects of the drugs and the effects of the condition. And they showed this correlation with drug treatment. So they have had to admit that the drugs do at least have some effect.
Going back into the history of psychiatry,
one of the characteristics that defined schizophrenia, or one of the things that was found about patients with schizophrenia, is that they didn't have physical diseases any differently from anyone else. But of course,
absolutely,
that's been dramatically changed by the drugs.
Absolutely, that you know that their brains were no different from other people's brains. That you know that was nothing categorically distinctively different about them anyway.
And then instead of looking at shadows on MRIs, they were looking at autopsy after autopsy, microscopically weighing the brain, feeling the brain, examining the brain, you know, of so many people who died in the state hospitals, and they really couldn't find a disorder that they could label schizophrenia in people. And they kind of gave up for a while, and now they're claiming to find it on these MRIs, which are, of course, the brain damage. We're going to go to break in a very short time. We're talking with Joanna Moncrief, a heroic person, a heroic psychiatrist in Great Britain, who thinks honestly and thinks clearly and has the courage to write the truth, and whom I greatly admire and count as a friend. When we come back, Joanna, after the break, it should be short, I'd love to have you talk some more about your own work, and if you like, about my work, where it fits into yours, where you might disagree, where you might agree. Any aspect of your work would be interesting, because it is rare to find a psychiatrist willing, obviously, to look deeply into these issues. So let's go to break. This is Dr. Peter Breggin, and you're listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, and my guest is Joanna Moncrief, Senior Lecturer, Department of Mental Health Sciences at the University College London. Her very good book, The Myth of the Chemical Cure, A Critique of Psychiatric Drug Treatment, and as some of you heard earlier, Joanna and I on one occasion took on the psychiatric establishment of Great Britain, and afterward they voted on the audience voted on who had won, Joanna and I, or the outstanding exemplars of the profession that debated us, the two gentlemen in this case. And I think the vote was like, you know, everybody for us except three people and two abstentions or something like that. You remember that? You remember the numbers from that, Joanna?
Not exactly, but I think you're in the right ballpark.
In the right ballpark. They can't afford open debate. Tell us more, if you would, about your work. You're talking about this very interesting and very important idea about how originally psychiatrists, the pioneers like Heinz Lehmann, recognized they were doing chemical lobotomies. They recognized they were producing apathy and indifference. They at times even compared, I think it was Anton Stevens, was he British, compared them to lobotomy. And then the PR people took over. The spin docs took over.
Yeah. I mean, Pierre Denneker, the French psychiatrist, wrote my favorite paper of that era in 1960 when he talked about how the drugs replaced schizophrenia with a neurological syndrome, in other words, with another neurological disease. And the disease that the drugs caused was a sort of variant of Parkinson's disease. And he thought that that was how they worked, because Parkinson's disease suppresses nervous activity and slows people down and damps down their emotional responses. he thought that it was this new nervous disease that was what was helping the schizophrenia. And I go back always to your idea of the brain disabling nature of these drugs, and completely agree with you that that's their fundamental, that the fundamental property of drugs that are used in psychiatry, particularly the antipsychotics, but to a certain extent all of them. Where I would disagree with you, I suppose, is that I think there are some times when, however unpleasant and harmful it sounds, that those drug treatments can be useful. If someone's really, really psychotic and nothing else can bring them out of it, I think sometimes the suppressant effects of those drugs do help to suppress the psychosis and help people to re-engage with reality again. The difficulty for me is when you stop drug treatment, because, you know, we just don't know enough about the long-term effects of these drugs, and we do have quite a lot of indications that they have some very serious, very dangerous long-term effects. We've been talking about the brain shrinkage, and they cause this neurological problem called tardive dyskinesia, which is when people get uncontrollable movements, and it's associated with mental impairment, with cognitive impairment as well. So I think the drugs can be useful in an acute psychotic crisis if alternatives don't work, and I always think that we should be trying alternatives first, because you really don't want to get people started on these drugs if you can avoid it. But I think we need to be trying to get people off them so that we avoid too many people being on them long term.
Is anyone in Great Britain talking about the need, other than yourself, to get people off drugs, which is a major theme of my own new book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal? Is we really need people thinking about this process, learning about the process, and my book is about outpatient withdrawal. We really need inpatient withdrawal for people who are on multiple drugs and have families that aren't very supportive or that are conflicted. There's practically no discussion of that over here within the medical profession. Is there any over in Great Britain?
Not very much. I get many calls from people who've been trying to withdraw themselves and finding it difficult and looking for help, and really it's very difficult to find help for them. They might be lucky and have a sympathetic general practitioner or even a sympathetic psychiatrist or psychiatric nurse, but there's little sort of mainstream or academic interest in it. So most practitioners don't really know very much about withdrawal. However, having said that, there is some interest in whether or not people with psychosis should be carried on drug treatment long term. And I know that the British Government Research Department has asked for people to put some research together to look at, to do a withdrawal trial to see if what the results are if people are taken off their antipsychotic drugs. So there's interest in some areas, but I think I know that there are still a lot of patients, people who've got onto antidepressants, finding it difficult to get off and struggling to find any support to do that.
Yes, that is, it's definitely true everywhere. You brought up the paper by Denneker from 1960 just to catch people up on who we were talking about and on another important aspect of what was realized early on. It was two Frenchmen, Delay, I'm not good on the pronunciations, Delay and Denneker, were the first to experiment with using chlorpromazine, what became Thorazine in the U.S. and Largactyl in Canada and Great Britain. They'd gotten the idea from a surgeon who'd given the drug to surgical patients and found that while it didn't necessarily stop pain, it made people indifferent to their pain. And these two guys were really aware of neurology, unlike modern psychiatrists. And they not only said that the effect was related to the Parkinsonism, the slowing down of the body and the mind, they noted that the long-term effects were similar to a disease called lethargic encephalitis, or von Economo's disease, which was an epidemic that occurred during World War I and lasted somewhat for maybe a decade or so after World War I. It was somewhat contemporaneous with the flu, but it was a different disorder. And the primary initiating characteristic of this flu-like syndrome, which was actually an encephalitis, was lethargy and indifference. And they noted that that was the same initial effect of the antipsychotic drugs. Then they noted that people were left with this encephalitis with after effects, sometimes a persisting psychosis, sometimes dementia, and sometimes a broad array of abnormal movements, which they also noted in the patients getting these drugs, which we now call tardive dyskinesia. So they saw the whole package, and one of them, I don't remember, was DeLay or Denica, said we could, if we gave this out to enough patients, create virtually a new epidemic of lethargic encephalitis. Most remarkable, and indeed that's what's happened. I mean, rarely have we seen this kind of knowledge and foreknowledge of a disaster while medicine and psychiatry nonetheless steamed full steam ahead to give these toxic agents out to people.
Yeah, it is incredible. It was, I can't remember exactly the name, but someone at that time called it, it's called the drug-induced state, the state that these neuroleptics could induce chemical encephalitis. What is extraordinary when you read these descriptions is that no one has any interest nowadays in what the drugs that we give out actually do to people. So you can look as hard as you like at most of the psychiatric literature on the SSRI antidepressants, the drugs like Prozac and things. It's almost impossible to find out what their psychoactive effects actually are. How do these drugs alter the way that people think and feel? It's just not there. No one's shown any interest in it. Unlike these early pioneers that you talk about who very meticulously noted down the alterations that their drugs caused in people. So I think, you know, I think it's extraordinary now that we're using all these drugs without any of that sort of knowledge of what they actually do.
You know, it's well put. Nowadays, when you read a drug study, it's a statistical table. There won't even be a clinical description of how the patients feel, how the patients themselves evaluate what is going on. There'll be nothing subjective at all. What we used to call, clinical studies are almost non-existent now. It's really become cleansed of humanity. Our profession is cleansed of humanity, yet it's supposed to be addressing the most serious personal ailments of humanity.
Well, I also think it's so ironic that, you know, the profession is so keen to promote the medical model, this idea that, you know, mental health problems are really medical diseases and can be approached and treated as medical diseases, and yet the profession doesn't really want to have the understanding that it needs to have about the drugs that it uses. It doesn't really have a good pharmacological grasp of its treatments.
I remember when I first started critiquing the antidepressants, Prozac it was, and I had a radio debate with a psychiatrist, just some ordinary fellow out in Colorado or somewhere, and he said that I was so wrong about Prozac, that Prozac wasn't even psychoactive, that it had no effect on moods, it just fixed depression.
Yes.
Now, few would be so bold-faced in lying as that, or be so informed or have such a wrong impression. But that's how psychiatry steams ahead. It's as if they're not giving psychoactive substances. They're giving insulin for diabetes. You know, they're not giving a psychoactive substance. Needless to say, insulin can become psychoactive, when you have an insulin reaction. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think there's a great reluctance to recognize that the drugs that we use have psychoactive effects. I mean, if we recognize that, we wouldn't give any credibility to any placebo-controlled trials because, of course, if you use a psychoactive substance and you compare it with a chalk tablet, there's going to be a difference. It doesn't mean that you've done anything useful or fundamental to the problem. It just means that you've given something to someone that makes them feel different. I mean, the thing with antidepressants, with the new antidepressants like Prozac that I think is interesting, is they have weaker psychoactive effects than the previous antidepressants and than the antipsychotics. So some people probably aren't going to notice, certainly immediately, that they've taken them. And that's where your idea of spellbinding is interesting, because if you take a dose of chlorpromazine, of Thorazine, you would know immediately. But if you take an SSRI, the effects on you are quite subtle. And I think people who take them are probably often not aware of how they're affecting them, and probably can only become fully aware of how they were affected when they've stopped taking them and can look back.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that. And one thing I do notice, though, is that after people have been on the antipsychotics for a while, they don't realize how totally flattened they are and how immobilized they are because of that spellbinding effect just creeps up on them. I'll never forget a father, when my office was back in Washington, D.C., rather than Ithaca, a father who came to D.C. to find out what was the matter with his daughter, who didn't sound right on the phone. She was in graduate school, and he went to see whom he remembered from 8 months earlier or so as a slender, vivacious, active, tennis-playing, brilliant, and lovely young woman whom he adored, and he found an overweight, sluggish, dull young woman whom was barely recognizable and who was one of the early people being given Zyprexa. And he took her to he was a wealthy man, and he got what he wanted done, so he took her to one of the top professors at one of the medical schools in downtown D.C. and was told that, oh, this was fine. His daughter was on the state-of-the-art latest drug. And he tried to appeal to the man and say, this does not even look like my daughter anymore. So then he took her to NIMH, to the top person there, and got the same story. And he's heartbroken. And then he somehow stumbled upon my name and brought her to me, and I instantly recognized these toxic effects. He practically cried with relief. But his daughter, when I asked her how she felt about coming to see me and so on, she said she's just tired of being led around to doctors. She was zombie-like.
Yeah.
We did eventually get her off the drugs, and occasionally I still get, occasional little notes from him or her about, thanks, things are going well. It was very hard to get her off, and it was very scary getting her off. But so, again, the person on the drug after a while can fall into these zombie states with barely recognizing it. Is that your experience, too?
Absolutely. I mean, I've worked for a long time with people with, who have the label of schizophrenia, and most of them have been on these antipsychotic drugs for years and years. And they can become, it can be very frightening for them when the drugs are lowered, which I almost always set out to do if they're stable. And suddenly they've got these emotions that have been dampened down for years and years. And many of them find that difficult to deal with. For some of them, it's great and it's a great relief, but some of them find it really frightening to have to experience these, these emotions that they've just not been used to experiencing for a long time.
Well, and of course they're experiencing the withdrawal emotions too, with the brain unmasked. The brain's been fighting against these drugs for a long time, so it's changed in its fight. It's reconfiguring itself to resist the effect of the toxic agents. So that's one of the problems, is the changed brain is being unmasked, just like taking a chronic alcoholic off alcohol. All of a sudden there's this brain that's now out of control because it's been fighting against something that's not there anymore. And also the person, I think, becomes more aware of the damage, the cognitive losses, the fact they can't remember their life hardly. So then they're experiencing that kind of loss. And of course they haven't grown over the years in handling their problems. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there's the emotions are exaggerated by withdrawal, so they're probably experiencing even stronger or more disrupted emotions than they would be normally or would have been before drug treatment. And then, as you say, there's the psychological difficulties that they've been suppressed for all this time and probably lost a whole long segment of their life and are having to face up to that. So... yeah, so I think it can be really difficult for people. You said something that made me want to make a point, comparing it to alcohol, and I use this example a lot when I'm trying to explain spellbinding to people, this idea that you came up with, this idea that when people are under the influence of a psychoactive drug, they're not necessarily the best judge of how they're functioning. Because of the effects of the drug. And I use the effects of alcohol, you know, because we're all familiar with the idea that if we have a few drinks, we're not very good judges of how we're behaving. And that's why we have drink driving laws. We don't trust people when they've had a few drinks to be able to judge whether or not they're safe drivers. So we actually have to legislate about that. And I think we could learn a lot from thinking about recreational drug use, because with recreational drugs, we do acknowledge they have psychoactive effects and withdrawal effects and damaging effects. And there are far more parallels, to my mind, between recreational drugs and psychiatric drugs than the psychiatric community is really too willing to acknowledge. Of course, many psychiatric drugs are quite unpleasant, so they're not necessarily what people would choose to take recreationally, but they're the same sort of drug in that they're psychoactive, they're mind-altering.
Yeah, and then, of course, there's a very close correspondence. The benzodiazepines have very similar effects to alcohol, affect the same neurotransmitter systems, but in different ways, and affect other transmitter systems. Then you have the stimulants we're giving to children, which are identical to the drugs of abuse for adults, the amphetamines, and very similar to cocaine. But other drugs, like the antipsychotic drugs, few people want to take recreationally, or lithium, although in this world we live in, some folks do it on occasion, but they have, you know, they usually don't really want to be taking these drugs. It takes a lot of pushing and cajoling, usually, to get people to take drugs like Zyprexa and Seroquel and so on. Of course, it's wonderful for me that you talk about some of my concepts. Do you want to talk about... in general, what it's like to be a critic of your own profession in England? I gather it may not be quite as painful as in the United States. Maybe take a minute of our last 2 minutes to talk about that.
Yes. Well, I said we were talking earlier about how difficult it is to get a discussion going. There are many like-minded psychiatrists around, and I go and talk a lot at psychiatric conferences and local educational meetings, and there are almost always some people that agree with me or are sympathetic to what I'm putting across, people who, you know, are worried about the effects of the drugs, they might think they're okay in certain circumstances, but they're, you know, careful and thoughtful about using them. So there's quite a section of the profession that's supportive, but it is just so difficult to get a proper debate going. And I think that's because there's another section of the profession that are very challenged by my ideas, by your ideas, by this whole idea that, you know, that the drugs are not reversing a chemical imbalance, that they're actually toxic substances that suppress the brain. I think that's very threatening to some people, and so it's frustrating because, you know, I can go around and talk about it and everyone says, yes, I agree with you, but I can't get grant money to study it properly.
Yes.
I can't get my ideas published in prominent journals properly, and I certainly can't get them debated properly.
Joanna, so tell us how people can get in touch with you. I think the music's going to start any second now. How can people get in touch with you?
The Critical Psychiatry Network has a website that anyone can look up and get in touch with a number of us through that. And I'm based at University College London. I can be emailed there or contacted there.
You want to announce your email? Make it easy for folks?
It's j.moncrief@ucl.ac.uk, but it's easy to find on the internet.
Joanna Moncrief, I am honored to know you, delighted that you are my friend. Wish we lived nearer to each other. Thank you so much for coming on my show.
Thank you, Peter. It's been a pleasure.